John Hollingsworth on the line.
Larry Johnson on the line. How you doing, John?
Good, Rob.
I'm not Rob, I'm Larry.
Oh, Larry, okay.
I haven't heard from Rob yet. It's probably due here in a minute, I expect.
Yeah, he's been busy.
Where are you living?
Pardon?
Where do you live?
Corrales.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm in Albuquerque, so...
Yeah, well, it's close.
I couldn't make the tea yesterday.
I don't think anybody had time yesterday, at least in the afternoon.
Yeah. Market was crazy, wasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I got one of my trades broken, thank God.
Oh, you did?
It was down 60%. Actually, it was down 99% when I got sold out. So.
Wow. Holy crap.
Yeah. I didn't get another one broken, though, unfortunately. It was only down 35% when I got sold out. So.
That's crazy. I don't know. I just had a... Did you get an email from Jeff by any chance?
No, I talked to him on the phone yesterday as the market closed, and I talked to him this morning. So.
Okay. Well, I guess I did better. I put a ridiculous buy order in, and it closed.
Well, if it closed within that period of time, which is about 40 minutes, and it was and the stock was... And there's a list, by the way, on the New York Stock Exchange of all the of what the 60% limit was and all the symbols, and it's also on NASDAQ too.
Well, I don't think mine may have gone down 60%, but when my buy order was not sitting low by 60%. So
hello, this is Rob.
Hello, Rob. This is Larry Johnson. I'm on the phone.
Hi, Larry.
John Hollingsworth.
Hi, John.
Hey. Cheryl Jernigan.
Hi, Cheryl. Well, great. Well, thanks for joining us, and maybe we'll just launch right into an overview of the markets and the economy. We'll talk a little bit about the very unsettling market action of yesterday, and kind of the continuing crisis that's going on in Europe, and how that's reflected in the U.S. markets. I have questions from both John and Larry, so we'll get to those after the overview.
Okay. Hey, Rob, what was the timing with your tea yesterday and the market thing? Some overlap there, or?
Well, yeah, the market doesn't like me taking time out for tea, so no. The real breakdown in market mechanisms happened around 3:40 New York time, which actually 2:40 New York time up until 4 o'clock. So that was from 12:40 here in New Mexico up until 2 o'clock. I was on a conference call, so
okay.
I can't be blamed for that one.
okay.
We might as well talk about that first, because they're not publicizing. Maybe they don't know yet how it happened. Whether it was a mistaken entry on the part of an institutional investor. That was the original story, that it was had to do with a sale order for Procter & Gamble shares.
Yeah.
Or whether it was just somehow. Some esoteric mismatch of buy and sell orders electronically that then got flipped over to manual or to other exchanges, and there were no buyers since those exchanges aren't used very much. I don't really think either one of those is going to end up being the full story about it, because there were many, many stocks that just kind of vaporized. A lot of trades happened at prices that were just not in the normal range of things. And my sense, and we're involved in pressing Schwab, and not that we have a lot of weight with any of the exchanges, but to have all of the trades that happened during that anomaly period to be canceled, as opposed to the Right, the 60% rule or some other arbitrary number. Why would 60% make any more sense than 30%?
Well, they went through and passed both the NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange passed the rule at 60% today, and they have posted the stock symbols that were affected and the price of which 60% down would be broken. And in my case, they broke it and returned it back already on one of them. So,
yes.
Okay.
We're not really satisfied with that, so we're going to take up the issue. If there were trades that happened, and there weren't that many, really, in our accounts, but some where, you know, where it wasn't 60%.
No, they didn't break my one that was sold out at 37% or 38%.
Yeah, and so we're going to take that up.
Okay.
With Schwab, because that's just flat-out wrong, just because it didn't hit some New Yorker's arbitrary level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The pressure on the markets from kind of the sort of the whiff of another global liquidity crisis, this time with sovereign debt in Europe, I think is really only part of the story. The Greek bonds and the Greek government, you know, continues to struggle as much with their own population and expectations as with the, you know, the banks who they're looking to for this financing help to see them over the maturing bonds that they have that they're really unable to refinance. I believe that a lot of the pressure that's going on now is are the other central banks in Europe making the point to the population of Europe that this is serious stuff, there are going to be consequences, and so they don't really mind if the markets are roiled by their inaction. It's a little bit like when the agencies here decided that they wouldn't bail out Lehman, sort of to teach a lesson to people.
Yeah.
And it ended up costing a lot more money as opposed to, and I think they learned that lesson, so I'm sure they will bail out Greece and support the other pig nations, that's Portugal, I guess Italy, Greece and Spain. Right. Yeah. So, and so what you're seeing in Europe is kind of the second layer of credit, where before the banks were in trouble and the governments bailed them out. Now you have governments in trouble and you have sort of a supranational agency, the IMF, which is essentially Chinese and oil money. There's some U.S. money in there, but that's where the IMF is getting their money now. And of course, the European Union getting their money from Germany. And those are the decision makers, or will be more so as time goes on. So at some point, I believe the markets settle down, not necessarily because Germany has the wherewithal to bail out, you know, all of the pig nations, but I think they're going to set a precedent and maybe get some action on those countries cutting their spending, and I'm not sure they're going to get them to change their culture of sort of tax avoidance and you know, graft, corruption. The entitlement to a social safety net that's really quite exorbitant in cost. Those are all hallmarks of a lot of Europe, really, not just the southern European nations. And those are, you know, going away without a doubt, not without, you know, riots and violence and things like that, which is very unfortunate. But those things are definitely going away. And
because they can't afford them.
Right. That's right. They can't afford them. That's right. No one can afford them, and so that coffin hasn't been shut yet, but it's on its way. The future is clear, but the people in Europe are so used to those large payments, like in Greece, the bonus payments, for example, that it's just really a change in culture, and those don't happen easily, and especially when they can be easily vilified as being imposed from the outside. The alternative is for, you know, Greece to leave the European Union, to default, to devalue its currency, all of the things, for example, that Argentina did a while back and is still struggling to, you know, to get back on its feet. So Europe, you know, we have almost no money in Europe and haven't for quite some time as a firm. Those markets are down, you know, very, very sharply this year. Let me pull it up on the Bloomberg. They're in deep bear territory right now, and the U.S., of course, is now back in negative territory for the year. In U.S. dollar terms, let's see, France, Spain, down more than 30%. England is down, 15%. Germany down 15% for the year. Australia, which is surprising, a natural resource economy, down 17%. And, you know, the U.S. is essentially flat. So that's one of the fallouts from the fact that the Europeans have higher costs, less flexibility in their markets than we do, is that the U.S. dollar and U.S. stocks have become very attractive to foreigners, and so we really have been the beneficiary of capital flows from that crisis. I'm not sure that continues for a lot longer, but probably for a while. I think the point, you know, driving home those points about changing the social network, social safety net, are really going to take some time. The European banks are at risk with the Greek default.
Yeah.
The European banks have already been bailed out by their governments, but they're now having another major structural risk because of their loans to the Greek banks. So I think that's enough about Europe. Since we're sort of traveling overseas virtually, let's talk a little bit about China and Britain. Those are, you know, some of the other big players. Britain has a very high debt level, not quite as high as the PIG countries, but up there. It has serious financing difficulties. The British pound and gilt, the bonds, are considered to be fairly safe relative to the rest of Europe, and so that's helped the UK finance their deficits. This election that is going on now and looks like it may drag on for a little bit in terms of, you know, forming. It's a little bit like our sort of, you know, presidency in question and left to the courts. Looks like in the UK that there isn't any real direction to their populace, so there'll be some kind of a coalition government, and that just adds to the uncertainty of what's going on in England. China, on the other hand, is still booming. We are short China in our portfolios, in some of them. We believe that China will have a serious pullback in their stock market and their real estate market. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze here in a minute. Let's see what happens there. And that, as a result, China has financed its own own recovery with its incredible surplus that it has garnered mostly at our and Europe expense, but by selling to us for the last decade. And so they've been buying up commodities, buying up oil around the world, Venezuela, Africa, wherever they can make a deal. But I think that the Chinese economy, because it is so overly emphasizing infrastructure and state-run companies, and there's, you know, such a overhang of government regulation and censorship on entrepreneurial activities, that they really are not that robust. They really don't. There are many, many industries that just can't take off in China, and so it's like you have these huge companies that can do certain things very well, and yet what it takes to create a sort of self-sustaining economy with domestic demand and entertainment, technology, research in the medical field, that really they're not unidimensional, but they're a narrow country, and that's going to come and haunt them fairly soon. That will reduce pressure on commodity prices around the world, and I'm not talking about oil per se, because oil is used for so many different things by so many people, but industrial commodities, that we see those really taking a break in their price increases. So all that is to say that in the U.S., when we look at the U.S. economy and what are the most important factors in the U.S., one being unemployment or employment changes, which affect consumer spending, in the news it looks, you know, there's good news that the economy adds 270,000 jobs, but at the same time, unemployment goes up from 9.7 to 9.9. There are a lot of people out of work. There are a lot of people who have stopped working, and the economists really feel that the that the total unemployed, you know, not just the ones who are signing up for unemployment insurance, that it's really around 17%. Before this, what they're calling the Great Recession of 2008-2009 unfolded, this metric of total unemployed had never gotten over 12. So unemployment is up about 50%. I'm sure everyone knows people who are unemployed or underemployed or part-time when they'd like to be working full-time. And the net result of high unemployment is, there are several. One is that residential real estate prices are continuing to be under pressure, downward pressure. And other than food and energy, there's a very strong strain of deflation, of lower wages, lower prices for things, unused capacity, and that, in effect, you know, we're living in an environment where none of us really can believe that we're in a low inflation environment. Just seems like most things like that we use, discretionary things, are going up, but wage inflation and real estate inflation are non-existent, and as a result, it is unlikely that the stocks will the equity markets will have that kind of inflationary bias at its back to propel it upwards. In a deflationary environment, income-producing instruments, whether they're bonds or stocks, or, you know, energy, and we'll talk a little bit about energy, those really become very valuable. They have the highest total return, and that's in fact what we've been emphasizing. So consumer spending, there are some bright spots. There are some jobs being created. We read the reports, the newspapers. Consumers are starting to spend more. Of course, some of that is the year-over-year sales comparisons with the big retailers are looking good because last year was so bad. But, you know, I think we're settling into a period where people with jobs are feeling more comfortable. They're not necessarily going out and buying, you know, bigger homes than they need because they feel like they want to get into something and that the appreciation will take care of the increased payments. So, we clearly have, you know, the benefit of all the government stimulus programs. The government program for first-time homebuyers has just ended at the end of last month. So, we see some select opportunities, you know, if the market continues to be pulled down by the European situation, we'll continue to add some stocks. But maybe with that, I'll stop and see whether there are any questions, and then I'll kind of about what I've said, and then I'll go back to the questions that some of you have already forwarded to me.
Rob?
Yes.
I didn't send you any questions today, but I'm always interested in real estate, and I don't know if you're going to cover this, but how the oil spill in the Gulf is going
right.
to affect everything, which, you know, is pretty disturbing the way it looks like it's just coming out of the ground. So.
Yeah. That actually was one of Larry's questions about what effect the oil spill will have on the U.S. gas market, natural gas, and also oil shares in the long run. The oil, of course, that's coming out of the well that's owned by British Petroleum, that the drilling rig was owned and operated by another company, Transocean. And they're the ones who are responsible for the explosion and that sort of thing. But because BP owns the oil, anything that the oil does is supposedly BP's responsibility. Now, in the past, there have always been caps on oil companies' liability because if you took the cost of the degradation of real estate, if the oil, and I haven't really seen any definitive statement that it's going to hit the coasts and ruin the coastlines in large measure, but I guess people don't know that yet, depending on the weather and what they're doing out in the ocean. But clearly, the potential costs of cleaning up the oil and the economic impact on fishermen on people living along the ocean frontage and shipping, you know, is enormous. It's I wouldn't know how to calculate it. It's so big and varied. So BP clearly is a company that may not survive in its present form, given the liability, unless Congress, you know, caps it. And that may well happen. Certainly that's what happened with Exxon the last time this magnitude happened. One of the impacts of the oil spill is there's no question that the whole deep sea offshore drilling is going to be highly regulated going forward. And, you know, when there's a problem, everyone starts to look under the rocks and sees the little bugs crawling around. That's kind of what's happening now is, you know, the whole safety issue, regulatory issue, or environmental issues. You know, a lot of those things were let slide because that's how things happen out in the field. Unlikely that that will be allowed to continue, and so even if there are new offshore drilling, the cost of doing it is going to be much higher, and that will get passed along to consumers. The environmental, impact, of course, is unknown and, maybe impossible to quantify. So I'm not sure I can really address that issue, Cheryl, is what the, net impact is. Certainly in the markets, the drilling companies, the oil, the gas companies and the oil companies that are involved in that area, basically their, marketplace just shrunk drastically and their costs went up drastically. So that can't be good for the companies. But, there are companies whose prices have been beat up probably unnecessarily or to a greater extent than they ought otherwise. Exxon is trading in the low 60s. And one impact of this whole incident and which is still happening, of course, is the political correctness or the openness of the public to going to nuclear power. I think the resistance will be diminished, and that's one area that we have definitely started to emphasize in our investment strategy. Even though there, obviously are problems with the nuclear option in terms of waste and safety and, dirty bomb materials, et cetera, which I think certainly in this country can be adequately managed, operators, nuclear utilities, all have fairly good long-term prospects now. So, Larry, does that address your question?
Yes, I think it does, Rob. Thank you.
Okay. And Cheryl,
The other thing that I don't understand about oil wells, I thought they had to pump that stuff. It sounds to me like these are gushers. Looks like they can't shut it off because is there pressure there that's pushing that up? I don't quite understand. All the surface oil wells you see around here, you have to pump. Now, well, if you want to stop the oil, well, you just shut off the pump. But seems to me like that oil is just gushing out there, and they can't stop it.
John, do you know something about that?
Yeah, they have to cap them. And the ones on the surface are no problems. You just cap them. Because when they first strike oil comes up, and if you're lucky, it doesn't catch fire. And then they are... They cap them off as such, and then they pump when they need to. Unfortunately, they can't pump, or they can't cap on the, and they're having trouble. They're going to try to drop that cap, that big concrete cap down onto it within the next few days or so. But that's the only way they can stop it. So the other alternative is crazy, which is you go down and drill a parallel well next to it to take the pressure off it. But that's like a long-term project. You can't do it overnight.
Yeah. So I guess there is a natural pressure that they're under that makes them spew oil once they've once something's been broken. And
that was my analysis of the thing. But I just compared to a surface well, it seems to be different. So that's.
Yeah, it's interesting, of course, is to see how the story changed over time in terms of the number of gallons that were being leaked a day. It started at 1,000 and then went to 5,000. The last time I saw it, it was 100,000 a day.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, I'm very confused. How, I know this, like everything else, is going to be passed on to us somehow, but... is it in the form of taxes? I know that since it's not an Exxon or a Chevron or a large oil company, how is that going to be done? Through the taxes?
It's not going to be passed. I think British Petroleum basically has committed themselves that they're going to pay for all the damage.
They have publicly when, you know, it's hard to identify, you know, the damages at this point to, let's say, the fishermen and their livelihoods or the shipping lanes and how long they'll be closed. They don't know where the oil is going to end up now or in 6 months or in a year. There may well be a cap. I think this is in front of Congress now in terms of what the monetary cap is on what BP will pay. And whatever it is, it's unlikely to cover the true cost to everyone of the damage. And so BP will likely, you know, I mean, BP made $4 billion last year. And so you'd figure they can pay that much and more if need be. I think since the extent of the damage is unknown at this point, it's just too hard to say, you know, who's how much it will be paid, how much needs to be paid by people outside of BP, you know, when that needs to happen, who's going to do it. They certainly say they'll do it, and I'm sure they will. I mean, if their net worth, if the value of the company is $104 billion, that's the value of the company. $104 billion. So, will it cost more than that? You know, will they liquidate the company and pay $100 billion? I think the cost of the Exxon, the Valdez cleanup, was somewhere around $6 billion. And Exxon had to pay, I think, something like $700 million of that, because the cap was set low, and the taxpayers did pick up the rest, or it just so that sort of is the best answer I can give, Cheryl.
Okay.
Because
I saw a special on that on the Alaska oil spill. I mean, we were talking about one tanker up there, and we're looking at way more than that in the Gulf of Mexico. Plus the fact that there's still a lot of places that have never been cleaned up there.
Yes.
And it was supposed to hit ground today, I understand, the oil, but I don't know what the weather has done to it.
The weather was supposed to have turned favorable for keeping it out to sea.
That's
good. So, let's expand the discussion and talk about energy in general. That was, I think, John, your question about the role of energy and the prospect for energy
in the future.
And
the stocks that we basically have.
Right, right, and the. So we have in our portfolios, you know, a tremendous amount of natural gas, pipelines and drillers, explorers, and the natural gas really hasn't, you know, the price of natural gas hasn't gone up much. There's considered to be an oversupply of natural gas in the country, which is pretty interesting. The areas of energy, the whole alternative energy is basically not going to be a factor in meeting the nation's energy needs for the next decade. However much publicity or however much anyone would like it to, it's really not a germane factor. The cost is still high of generating large amounts of electricity. And so natural gas, coal, nuclear, and oil, you know, and each one is different. Oil is the most easily used to transport, and natural gas, of course, is quite volatile and dangerous, but really the very clean. And so in a sense, it's kind of like the tortoise in the race. It's just it's very slow moving. There's a lot of infrastructure involved in natural gas. I don't believe we'll ever see natural gas as a main source of vehicle propulsion, but for generating electricity and heat and things like that, natural gas works very well. And we tend to buy, as investments, you know, they're not all utilities, but they're utility-like investments. So we, you know, they may have done well, but we own them not only for their dividends, but primarily for their dividends. And so I don't see in sort of even, I mean, when everything was down in 2008, they were down. But they're back strongly, and their cash flows and dividend payouts were essentially untouched during that whole period. And I would say every one of our clients has, you know, an overweighting of natural gas. In the other energy areas, you know, coal, they're low sulfur coal companies. It's not an area that we have tended to emphasize as much as natural gas. Ultra Petroleum, you know, is a holding. Magellan Midstreams, Enerplus, Energy Transfer, they're all natural gas companies. And nuclear, as I mentioned earlier, is an area that we're starting to expand into, and you'll likely see some buys in that area if that's basically fits into your profile. That'd be an acceptable buy. Some people it's not, but we're doing that through buying baskets that represent a wide variety of nuclear companies. We're buying. In fact, one of the stocks that was pummeled yesterday was Exelon, which is one of the big nuclear utilities. And then there are French sort of operator utility companies that were buying. Nuclear energy tends not to have the high dividends that natural gas does. So we're comfortable that even under pressure, those kinds of investments won't go down as much as the general market, and that they're very high cash flows, you know, 5 to 8% are fairly secure. So that's where we stand on natural gas. And does that address your question, John?
Yeah, because I'm so heavy into energy that... If it doesn't look that great. And actually, what the oil prices have, what, they fell $11 a barrel this week, so
yeah,
and they're very close to 75, and they closed this afternoon. But as long as you feel strongly that we should be that heavy, but I
do. I think it's one of the areas as opposed to you know, commodities. We have a little bit of commodities across the board, but I think the pricing on that is going to be weak. Natural gas really has, you know, no place to go but up in terms of it. The stock price. Mm-hmm. I mean, the stock of natural gas, the resource itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've been very interested and have been buying high dividend stocks, and we're looking at a potential increase in tax rates next year for people. And for high-income people, I mean, the tax rate on dividends for people earning over $250,000 will go up as high as 40%, but for people earning less than $250,000, the tax rate on dividends, you know, the max rate stays at 15%, which is really outstanding. They become really compelling bond alternatives if the underlying company is stable. And I think the U.S. multinational companies that pay high dividends, that have very highly valuable brand name recognition, you know, stand to hold up pretty well. We have in our strategy, as far as the overall flow of capital into this country from Europe, and the general deflationary impact of high unemployment and lower, you know, lower real estate prices and high foreclosure rate. Talk a little bit more about real estate. We have for the first time really taken positions in treasuries in you know, treasury funds, exchange traded funds, you know, that are paying around 3%, and they're, you know, to us they're a little bit more than cash alternatives, since cash and the banks are still not paying anything on money markets or savings accounts or CDs or anything. So we're very, I wouldn't say nervous, but we're very wary and watch the treasuries that we own closely. But it's possible that, you know, given all of this unease, that the treasuries continue to rally through the end of the year and that rates actually don't go up in the U.S. for another year or so. And the stock market would like that, you know, very much. So we've made some commitments into the high quality treasury market, and that's been a good thing because of the inflows from Europe. So let's see, any other questions come to mind from anyone?
No, not for me.
I'm good.
Emily, any questions? I'm just joking because Emily's still working on figuring out the trades that happened yesterday. So she was going to join us on this call, and she's been tied to her computer all day working on a spreadsheet that we're going to send to Schwab. So let's just talk about real estate for a moment. Where the opportunities might be, the dangers. Mortgage rates have fallen recently slightly as money has come in. And, you know, the government has ended its purchase of agencies in the open market. It's kind of discontinued its extraordinary measures to make sure that people have enough confidence to make those credit markets work. The prices of real estate continues to go down, and a foreclosure rate continues to go up. There are estimates that there are 7 million single-family residential mortgages that are underwater, wow, that are delinquent in their payments, and that about half of them people will walk away from, whether they made a down payment or not. But that 3.5 million homes coming onto the market, I think the market soaks up, you know, a million and a half homes a year. So that's about a 2-year supply coming into the market. And that's clearly deflationary and pushing the prices of the competing homes downward. When there's an oversupply, it's a lot of homes. It's not just subprime anymore. There are high-end homes being foreclosed on, people walking away from. And I don't know, in some ways it seems to me that the social stigma of walking away from your home mortgage is not as bad now as it was traditionally. And that people who actually can afford to pay their mortgage, if the value goes down to the point where they're clearly not going to recoup their value, they figure, well, why make those big mortgage payments? Why not just walk away and, you know, start over or do something different? I'm not quite sure of the ethical logic of that in terms of credit ratings. But that's the expectation, is that a tremendous number of people will walk away from their mortgages in 2010, going into 2011. So I hope you like where you live. I hope you like where you live.
How about the apartment type REITs and so forth?
Right, the apartment type REITs we like, and we've done very well with them. United Dominion Realty is one of them. Avalon Bay is another. Both with very good dividends, and that's where our focus has been, in the residential multifamily apartment complexes, generally on the high end of the spectrum. The prices have gone up so much it's hard to buy them. We're thinking about taking some profits off the table in those, and as their prices have gone up, of course the cash flow as a percent of the market value has gone down, so that they're yielding lower. So they're not as compelling as income instruments, but we think the rental market and especially for good quality things is quite robust and likely to stay that way. What else? What other topics are of interest to anyone?
Rob, I think I'm going to have to bow out, so thank you very much.
You're welcome, Larry. Thanks for joining
us. Talk to you later. Thank you.
Great. Bye.
Bye.
In light of the unfortunate stop loss effects of yesterday,
yes,
that'll change your strategy on the stop losses or not?
You know,
it's too early to tell, but I think it's a topic that you got to start discussing.
Well, you know, I was thinking about it last night and this morning, big time. We never use them categorically for everyone, and they were always set and have been set based on an individual client's tolerance for volatility. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, we certainly on the upside we would sell half positions, but on the downside, if we own a company, we have to believe in it. Otherwise, there's no reason to own it, and there are different reasons to have stop losses. One is to protect against gains, or for people who are unable to bear, you know, a wide swing in the value of their account. I think it will change my strategy. I want to see how they handle this, really, John, because if Schwab and the stock exchanges don't make good on undoing the trades that were clearly a result of the misfunctioning of the system, then I'm going to change the strategy drastically.
Yeah, because I think it exposes you. Because there's no, if it can bust through, and by the time that you get sold out, you're so far below your stop loss point.
Well, and generally there's a way of handling that. That's actually not going to happen. I'm fairly confident that they're going to honor the stop loss prices on most of the trades. So I don't think we're going to be tremendously hurt. But from a conceptual perspective, you're right. There's something called a stop limit loss, where you can say, if it goes down below a certain point, I want to sell, but here's the least, here's what I need to get in order to do the trade.
That would have been good yesterday.
Yes.
It would have stopped a lot of those stop-loss sales.
Yes. Yes. I'm hopeful that, that it really wouldn't have made a difference, that we're going to get our stop-loss prices in all cases,
mm-hmm.
and nothing below that unless the stock, of course, is trading today below that level, which is true in some cases, in some stocks. I mean, some stocks in the last, you know, since the first of April, you know, are down 10% or 15%. So I think I'm going to hold off on answering that. I certainly am looking at other strategies to accomplish the same thing. And, you know, my confidence in the way that these markets are set up electronically is severely shaken at this point. And so, you know, whether they do the right thing or not, the 60% rule is not enough, in my opinion.
No, not if you took like that one, 38%, 39% from them.
Right, that's right. And so, if they don't do the right thing, if they don't do what's right, then we will change our strategy and we will do something markedly different so that we're not relying on that market.
Okay. I think it's too early to say, but it's
yeah.
something that has to be looked at. So.
It does, and you know, there's very little being discussed publicly about it.
I know it. The only information that showed up is a small brief on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. It's on Schwab's website too.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, Schwab is very well aware. There are, you know, a lot of people who were affected, and I am not, you know, if they don't do the right thing, I am not going to continue on and allow them to do that again, or even, you know, reward them with our business if there's a way I can figure out around it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the only thing I had.
Yeah, good questions. Well, thanks for joining the call.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks,
that
Cheryl.
Was very informative.
Good. Okay, well, take care, everyone.
Okay,
bye.
Bye.